Hey, welcome to the 6 Minute Mile podcast, where our guest today is Catherine Switzer. Catherine was a junior at Syracuse University when she decided she wanted to run the 1967 Boston Marathon. Not such a big deal today, but back then Syracuse didn't even offer varsity sports for women. The longest distance they were allowed to race was a mile and a half. In order to even train, Catherine had to walk onto the men's cross-country team. That's where an assistant coach, Arnie Briggs, who was the mailman for the Syracuse campus, told Catherine no way could a woman run a marathon. She finally changed Arnie's mind after doing a 31-mile training run together, but she had much bigger problems ahead. By signing up for the marathon as KV Switzer, the organizers assumed she was a man and gave her bib number 261. Things went okay on Marathon Monday at first, until a cranky old Scotsman named Jock Semple caught wind of a woman on his course. As race director of the marathon, Jock felt it was his duty to grab Catherine and tear bib 261 off her sweatshirt. His clumsy attempt was captured on camera, and the images found their way onto newspapers around the world. Catherine was a reluctant hero in 1967 who started out just wanting to run a marathon. But a few miles after Jock attacked her, even mid-race, she began to understand the gravity of the moment. She went on to help launch a women's sports movement that led directly to Title IX in 1972 and the first ever women's Olympic marathon in LA in 1984. Despite her humility and real running talent, she won the 1974 New York Marathon with a sub-3-hour race time. Jock remained mad at Catherine for years and never turned down an opportunity to tell the media that he did the right thing in 1967. We've heard Catherine's story many times, but the one angle we could never quite figure out was why she was willing to forgive a man who was never willing to forgive her. Even Jock's own wife was mad at him for years for mistreating Catherine. But she took the high road at every turn. In spite of their rocky past, Catherine and Jock developed a sincere friendship, even sharing one last visit shortly before his death. Our conversation with Catherine explains how that unlikely friendship evolved and lots more stories from her remarkable career. Thanks for joining us.
My personal view is I think the world needs some more redemption and forgiveness in general right now different ways. And so I'm really fascinated by that Jock Semple relationship. And, I watched that interview of you with him from the late 70s, and it seems as if he never quite got all the way to a full apology to you, but it seems like a sincere relationship nonetheless.
Yeah. Jock Semple never apologized to me, which is really interesting, but he did in his own way. And let's go back to the incident itself, please. which he was incendiary and out of control. And I had never been manhandled by anybody in my life or attacked or, you know, that verbally abused even. So to have him attack me in the Boston Marathon as a total surprise, and I was blindsided by it as well, really, really kind of unnerved me and made me feel, have I done something terribly wrong? And then I got angry and I was humiliated and I was also frightened. I was really scared because there was quite a hubbub, and also because my boyfriend, as you know, decked him. And right. When my boyfriend decked him, he really hit him hard. And I thought, now we're in serious trouble. Yeah. Women have a tendency, of course, to take the blame. Rather than me being totally angry at him, I said, gee, have I done something wrong? And because we knew we were walking a fine line. My coach had insisted that I sign up for the race. He said, it's a serious race. You cannot go up to Boston and jump in the race. And he said, you have to pay your entry fee. If you get your travel permits, you're a member of the AAU. You've got to follow the rules here. And he said, and those guys up in Boston are really tough bastards.
Foreshadowing.
I really found out. Well, after Jock attacked me, then we tore down the road really fast. The press truck was very abusive to us and saying, what are we trying to prove and all this kind of stuff.
So the press truck got a little abuse. I assume it was probably all men on the truck.
They were, they weren't abusive, like, you know, sure, you idiot, you know, you clown. They were saying, when are you going to quit? They kept saying, when are you going to quit? Because they couldn't believe a woman was going to do it. Wow. And couldn't, and I had no intention or even fear of quitting, because I had run 31 miles 2 weeks before in practice. I said, there's no way, this is easy for me compared to what I was doing in Syracuse. Yeah. And so that's when I told my coach, no matter what, I'm going to finish this race. On my hands and my knees, I'm going to finish this race. And he said, okay, let's just slow down and let's just get it together. Well, the press truck finally left us after saying, when are you going to quit? What are you trying to prove? You know, you're not really going all the way. This is just a one-off deal, right? You know, that kind of stuff. Finally, they left when I was just not talking. And
so you did not respond to them.
I did at first. You know, where are you from? I said, I'm a student at Syracuse University and studying journalism, and these are my friends and my Syracuse track club. And they were writing all this down, and what's the K for? And that's for Catherine. And you know, of course, they thought I had faked my entry by signing my initials, and which is not true, because that's how I signed my name, is KV Switzer. Mostly because my dad misspelled my name anyway on my birth certificate. It was always getting misspelled. And the other reason was because I wanted to be J.D. Salinger or E.E. Cummings.
Oh, I like that. You know, yes.
I wanted to be a writer. You know, I wanted to be famous. I wanted to be W.B. Yeats.
Love it.
Anyway, they drifted away. Then the bus came by with the officials and the scribes, the journalists who were typing on their knees. They had little typewriters. And in those days, they would cover the race for the different checkpoints, you know, the train stations and the odd checkpoints at Boston. And they had young men on bicycles waiting for their copy. And they would pass their copy out the window, and they would bike it back into the newsroom where it was being set into type. So the races were unfolding in the news as we were running. I mean, it's an amazing story. I mean, in many ways, the news, there was a lot more news then than now, certainly a lot less fake news.
True. True.
Because in Boston, there were seven different newspapers and they all had three editions a day. Yeah. You know, people live for those newspapers. Anyway, so the on the bus also, though, was Jock Semple and Will Cloney, the co-race directors. And I was so relieved to see Jock on the bus, because I thought Tom had really hurt him. And he was standing on the running board. In those days, you had a running board, and he held that bar.
Right, right.
And he shook his finger at us like this. And he said, you all are in big trouble. Well, you know what all the guys did, you know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, get out of here, Jock. And he went on up to the start of the race, where he should have been in the first place, I thought. And then obviously when he came into the finish, he went immediately to his office or the phone or whatever, and called the Amateur Athletic Union office and said that this had happened, that I should be disqualified and expelled from the Federation. And Olin Castle at the time was the head of the Athletic Federation, and to his eternal disgrace and our eternal unfriendship, he sent me a special delivery letter, which arrived in my dorm 2 days later, expelling me from the Athletic Federation.
On what grounds?
Because I had run with men, which was, I hated that, because it was like a sexual implication, you know? Really, I thought it was really sleazy. I thought it was very sleazy.
Wow. Yeah.
And the second one was because I had run more than a mile and a half, which was the longest distance allowed for women in cross country. Because I had fraudulently entered the race by signing my initials, even though men had signed with their initials in the entry form. And also the last one, the best, was because I'd run without a chaperone. So anyway, we burned our AAU cards. We were like draft dodgers.
Yeah,
that's
it.
No more AAU. We had it. But anyway, getting back to the race itself. So that was Jock, what he was up to. Unbeknownst to me, as I was running toward, you know, funny things happen to you after 30 Ks in a race. I began to feel slightly paranoid. And I said to Arnie, I said, you know, when we come to these intersections and the big Boston cops are there directing traffic, okay? I said, I just really worry that these guys are going to do something. And he said, yeah, me too. And I said, okay, well, look, we're going to resist arrest, right? And he said, okay, you do, I do. it was really quite exciting. But I kept thinking, and instead all these big Irish cops were really nice.
Oh, come on.
You
know, good.
Hey, you go for it. And I'd lost my gloves in the scuffle. And one of them gave me his gloves. Oh, and they were soaking wet. But well, said, yeah,
my grandfather was a mounted cop in Boston. So that's nice to hear that maybe he was.
Yeah, they were. But boy, they were big guys. You know, they were really big guys. Anyway, when I came into the finish line, there were more aggressive journalists. One was really nice. I got two nice reports. One was the nice one was from, remember that wonderful guy, Joe. Oh God, why am I getting brain cramps this morning? I keep wanting to say Joe Kincannon.
Oh,
Joe
Kincannon. Of course. Yeah, forever.
Yeah, he was a Cub reporter. This is his first race. And I think probably they gave him the kid the assignment to say, hey, there's a girl running, go out and cover
it.
And he paid attention to me, wanted to know about clubbing, found out that, you know, yeah, I'd run in cross country races and 800 meter races and that he was really the only one who covered me decently.
Interesting.
So, and the other ones were saying, you know, she'd really look pretty nice if she would wear silk and tulle and I could take her for tea at the Ritz. And I said, what?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, gosh. Yeah. You don't know, because we were all soggy and cold. Anyway, somewhere over Heartbreak Hill, I stopped being angry at Jock Semple. And, you know, you can't keep anger when you run 21 miles, it goes and your emotions are just all laid open. And so a lot of things, you know, you shed. And I realized I'd been murdering him for 21 miles and I suddenly realized it wasn't his fault.
Yeah.
You know, he's a product of his time.
Yeah.
And, right. And that's what it was. I said, he's just a product of his time. I happen to be around a bunch of guys who run, who think it's great that I'm here and are very supportive. The guys are wonderful. And, they were all
the guys in the race.
In the race. They
Your
were
fellow
saying,
runners,
wish, yeah. Yeah. They were saying, wish my wife would run. I wish my girlfriend would run. We're glad you're here. You know, and that wouldn't happen in football.
No. But that's reassuring.
Really
that's
nice.
Great.
Yeah. So, I mean, from the get-go, the sport has been inclusive and supportive. So anyway, but I said, you know, it's just not his fault. He's a product of his time. And it's the burden of responsibility is now on me to change attitudes like that. But I don't know quite how to do it. I mean, I was only 20 years old. And I didn't even know what the women's liberation movement was. I didn't even know what it was all about. I mean, equal pay, sure. You know, birth control, sure. Yeah, yeah. You know, that's that. But I didn't realize this broader thing. And then I started getting angry at women. I said, why aren't they here? Why don't they get it? You know, it's just.
During the race?
Yeah, I've been thinking, why aren't they here? This is so wonderful. I feel great. And the guys are wondering, why aren't they here? And I thought, oh my God, it's because they're afraid.
Yeah,
you know, I really did realize that they were afraid, you know, that at, you know, when I started running at 12, they were told, no, you shouldn't run and you should, you know, wear your party clothes and feminine and start, you know, working toward being a nice wife and mother. And that running was dangerous and that your uterus was going to fall out and your legs are going to get big and grow hair in your chest. The scare tactics, which exist in many countries in the world still today, by the way.
Right, okay. Absolutely.
Were just ridiculous for me because, you know, I came from great pioneering stock and had great supportive parents and a working mom. And so I thought, you know, my dad always said, take responsibility. So I felt, when I finish this race, I've got to take responsibility and I want to become a better athlete and I want to create these opportunities. And I didn't know what either one of them quite looked like at the time, but I knew that that was my goal. But anyway, I was no longer angry at Jock. And so the journalist at the finish line said, so what are you going to do about Jock Semple? I mean, he attacked you. And I said, oh, look, he's just an overworked race director. He lost his temper. You know, he'll come around to realizing that girls deserve to run. Well, he didn't take that attitude. Jock went into tirades about women should know their place. This girl was stepping out of line.
Right there on the spot with the reporters.
No, well, he did his own reporters inside.
Sure,
he was nowhere to be seen. But Will Cloney, who was kind of the more debonair of the two, he was the co-race director, said, said, if that girl were my daughter, I'd spank her. Well, my mother, that was in the New York Times and the Washington Post. My mother went berserk. And when I called my parents, after the race, my mother said, my God, she said, we had no idea any of this was going to happen. We're getting calls from lawyers and they think that you should sue him. And I said, don't be ridiculous, mother. He's an overworked race director. He's just, a guy, a product of his time. Right. But Jock kept going on and on and on. And every day the press would call him, and every day he would have another ridiculous statement. And of course the press really enjoyed Jock Semple because he was a character and he would say the most outrageous things. And so he was terribly quotable. Then they would call me and they'd say what he said. And I would just laugh and say, listen, Jock doesn't have anything to worry about. I'm not going to be suing anybody. We just need to move ahead and help women have opportunities. And one quote that Jock gave was, even my wife is mad at me. He said, my wife feeds the dog the roast beef and she gives me Swanson's.
That is a good quote.
You know, those Swanson TV dinners.
Oh, of course. His wife was mad because he was mean to you?
Yes. He said, even my wife is mad. Yes.
Good for her. Yes. Yeah, great.
Yes, because he must have been a very difficult man to live with, I must say.
I can imagine.
So, well, anyway. Yeah, but it continued.
Well, no,
go ahead.
Yeah, I know. I'm kind of curious if he had not done this, did you have a press plan? Did you plan to tell Syracuse reporters or something that you had just run this or?
No, we didn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
I told Arnie, please let's not tell anybody we're going to do this because it's going to create a stir. I just want to go run. That's all I want to do. And he said, right. He said, let's just run. And he said, you can do it. And you've always wanted to do it. And I got to hand it to him. I mean, he was a 50-year-old guy. He was just a letter carrier, a
amazing,
simple, sweet guy.
Yeah.
It is. He's the hero of the story, really.
I always assumed he was the Syracuse cross country coach when I'd read these stories, but it turns out he was kind of a local guy.
Yeah, but he was a volunteer coach.
Okay.
So what, because he was a university mailman, but he was a good runner. And so for 30 years, he would finish his mail route and go out and train with the boys. And because he was a marathoner, do the fast work with them and then do his long work on the weekend himself. But as he got older, the coach was relying on him. And so when I met him, he was holding a clipboard and a whistle and helping get the practice going. And he was just kind of the team manager and the lovable old guy, Mr. Chips kind of person.
Sure.
And then when I showed up, he was so excited. He said, I've been out here for 31 years. Never had a woman. And he said, I'm Arnie and I'm the manager and I'll be, helping you and do anything you want. And then he immediately saw how slow I was that he started jogging with me and sort of taking me under his wing. I mean, I got lost on the cross country course every day.
So. Right.
These guys are good. These guys are scholarship boys,
Right.
But anyway, and then we took to the roads and the boys, when it got wintertime, gave up and went into the field house and trained. And I stayed out in the snow with Arnie because I couldn't stand it indoors on an indoor track. Yeah. And he said, I've never had anybody ever to run with me in the snow because Syracuse is notorious.
Absolutely.
For terrible. And we ran through blizzards. And it was during one night during a blizzard when I said, he was telling me another Boston Marathon story when I said, oh, Arnie, let's just quit talking about the damn marathon and run it. I want to run it. And he said, oh, a woman can't do that. And I said, why not? And he said, because women are too weak and too fragile. And I said, it's a blizzard in the black of night,
right?
10 miles.
Yeah, look around.
And Syracuse. Yeah. And I said, and you're saying I'm weak and fragile. He said, 10 miles isn't 26. And we argued and argued. And I told him, look, other women had run marathons and Roberta Gibb had jumped out of the bushes the year before in Boston. And he wouldn't believe it. He absolutely said, no woman ever did that. He said, that's all fake news. And so he said, but if you show me in practice, I'll take you. And that was it. I said, oh, you're on. And the day we ran our 26 miles, I said, let's run another 5. I don't believe this is long enough. We ran 31 and he passed out at the end of the workout. And he woke up and he said, women have hidden potential in endurance and stamina, which, you know, as you know, is the thing that's changing our sport right now so dramatically.
Oh, absolutely. There are people who think that
the capacity of women.
Absolutely. Yeah. And certainly for ultra distances, they think women may wind up breaking world records at 100-mile races, and that could get to the marathon.
Yeah. Yep. I was checking this stat online because of this other speech, and there was a medical report that said definitely over 195 miles women exceed men's performances. Well, we know that they're winning the 100-mile ultras, yes. They're, you know, the great mountain races, and here in New Zealand, when we have a Grand Traverse with three men, three women on the team, the guys and some of the best mountain runners in the world are here. They said the women always bring the team home. And I said, why is that? And they say, A, they don't get sleepy.
Right, yeah. Right.
And the second thing is they keep their cognitive thinking. They can read the compass. We can't read the compass anymore. Oh, isn't that interesting?
Interesting, wow.
And I said, biology never lies.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
right.
If you have six babies at home that are screaming and you don't sleep for days on end, and you don't blow their brains out,
yeah.
you know, there's Mother Nature provides these things, but actually it's also because of the estrogen in the system and actually the fuel source, the fat fuel source that we have. And it's cool in terms of women's equality, because it doesn't mean that men are better because they have more speed, power, and strength, or women are better because they have endurance, stamina, flexibility, balance. It's just that women haven't had opportunities for 3,000 years. And now we're just emerging. It's really exciting.
And absolutely.
For your generation.
And speaking of which, one of the things when I was reading some of these stories about you, Syracuse had no women's sports at the time you were there. I found that, you know, hard to comprehend. You know, my daughter certainly would not understand that. And Syracuse is a women's sports powerhouse now, right?
So, absolutely.
But that's shocking to me. What was the atmosphere like for women who wanted to stay active?
They had play days once a year. And they had a very active women's athletic department, which had intramurals and those. But it wasn't, to me, it wasn't serious. If you're serious, you know, you're gonna play other schools, you're in the league, whatever. And they had hockey, field hockey, they had basketball. I think they had fencing. I think there was swimming in those days, maybe. But I knew men had swimming. I'm not sure about women. But it was the play days that killed me. A play day, you know.
What does a play day mean?
A play day is like once a year you have the you go out and you play all different sports and you have relays and fun and. You know, don't you remember that when you're in elementary school? It was like May Day.
But that would be, of course, you know, it was the best day of the year in elementary school, but you'd think they'd have something a little more sophisticated for college. But
you would. We would indeed. Hey, but we got to finish the Jock Semple piece, and I've gone on
absolutely.
About it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So I had forgiven him, and he kept going on about this. And he went on and on and on about it. And the press kept feeding on it. They kept saying, you know, Jock Semple short fused, Catherine Switzer's forgiven him. And he wasn't having a bar of it. You know, he was still going to be mad. And he's taken the approach that he was right. He was absolutely right. And I deserve to be attacked. And that's the way it happens. When Jock had attacked a lot of other people, men, you know, he had pushed them around and he had no time for people who were fools. So the guy who showed up wearing the sign that said "Eat at Joe's Bar and Grill," he got decked. The Harvard boys who showed up drunk to lead the race and be on TV, you know, he decked. you know, the stories are legend,
okay.
And so he had a reputation for this. But you know, the fact that he actually physically attacked a woman in public that was a pretty bad thing. Nowadays, I probably would have to sue him, you know, because it really was assault and battery. But then I said, that's only going to fan the flames. You know, I'm going to take the high road here. We're going to create opportunities. And in the end, I know I'm right. I know I'm right that women will run if you give them opportunities. But if you scare the hell out of them like that, that's exactly the thing that they're afraid of. So I got, as I say, suspended from the AAU. And what I did is Arnie and I and my teammates went back and we organized a club, our own club in Syracuse, and it grew. And we had a lot of races. Pretty soon it got to be the second biggest club in New York, next to the New York
Roadrunners. A women's club or all gender?
No, women were welcome, okay, all genders, great. You know. A lot of women came to run some of the track events, but they didn't want to do the road race, which was 10K is every Tuesday night. That's okay. You know, take it step by step. We're here. We're giving you the opportunity. I then took leadership roles in the AAU. I got reinstated and I created the position of women's long distance running in upstate New York and started, okay, I'll work within the organization as well. Learned how to get sponsorship, wrote my press releases, da, da, da. Jock was still angry. And women, more and more women were showing up at Boston, and they were good. Sarah Berman, Nina Cusick, Jackie Hansen. And we, as women do often, bound together, and we said, okay, we're going to show up every year. We're going to run. We're going to comport ourselves really well. We're going to win over the media. We're going to win over the public. And Pretty soon people began really following the women's race. We also worked within the AAU, showing legislation, doing the legislation, and got women official finally in longer races. And Jock had to welcome us into the race in 1972.
Officially, that was the first official.
Officially, race. He had to do it. It was an AAU mandate. And so that was the first race that showed up. You know, it wasn't New York the first one that showed up. It turned out it was Boston. So he had to welcome us into the race. And as he said, well, I welcome you ladies into the Boston Marathon, but you can't run unless you meet the men's qualifying standard, 3:30. Well, eight of us could, eight of us were there. And it was great. It was like we ran for the first time as athletes, not as females. And we, you know, and it was a hot day and it was hard for us, but we did well. I finished third in the race and got a trophy. And Jock had to present the trophy to me.
No.
Yes. And there was no fanfare. There's no like ceremony. It was just like in a box. And he took it out
here.
And he handed it to me. And it was broken. It had gotten broken in the shipping. And he then, of course, was quite humiliated by that. And I laughed and I said, hey, Jock, it's okay. You know, he said, no, send it back. I'll have it repaired. And then he said, I've been mad at you for 5 years and you deserve a broken trophy.
Oh, man.
Just couldn't let it go. The next year on the starting line, we had starting line position. He came up to me, put a big kiss on my cheek and turned me around to the TV cameras. And at first he grabbed me and I thought, oh my God, what have I done? Right.
Here we go again.
And
yeah.
Big kiss in his Scottish brogue. He said, come on, lass, let's get a wee bit of notoriety. And that picture was in the New York Times the next day. And it said, the end of an era. Is a old Jock Semple welcomes Catherine Switzer like this into the Boston Marathon. Women are on their way. And after that, we really became good friends. We would do speeches together, panels together. He never apologized. I did a fun thing when he launched his book. I was the surprise guest and I hid behind the curtains and I ran out on the stage and attacked him and tried to pull him off the podium. And we started having barrels of fun like that and doing talks in that interview you mentioned for WGBH.
Yeah.
And then when he was in the hospital dying, I went in to see him a couple of days before and had a good talk. And his final words to me were, I made you famous, lass. And I thought, you know, for all the amazing, amazing things that Jock Semple actually did for running, which were quite a lot. I mean, he saved the Boston Marathon in many ways through the tough years when people wanted it to go away. And it was his baby. He was protecting his baby from all the fools. And it just took him a long time to realize I wasn't one of them. And I thought, I said, you know, when his obituary comes out the next day in the paper, it's going to be... it's going to tell some of the things, great things he did, but they will run that picture. They will run that. And they did. And they did. And he had said once, I found this only out last year, that he told a friend of mine also, he said, the friend said, do you have any regrets in your life? And he said, yeah, I regret that incident. And
so that's the closest he came to an apology.
Yeah. Yeah. But he told that to a friend.
Understood. You know,
He didn't know it was going to come back to me, but he did say, at least he said that to that friend. But here's the point. People say, wow, how can you have that much forgiveness? Well, first of all, I forgave him not at the get-go, but 2 hours after the get-go, because I could understand what he was trying to do, and he was a product of his time. And then how can you not also forgive somebody who gave you the worst thing in your life that became the best thing in your life? And how can you not forgive and love somebody who had changed the lives of millions of women around the world, and given the women's rights movement and the civil rights movement one of the greatest photographs in the world? I mean, you gotta admit that photograph is going to be around a lot longer than any of us.
It is iconic, absolutely.
Amazing. But it's been, the forgiveness is really important. You know, it's a lot of baggage to hang on to hate and resentment. You know, just let it go. Figure out the solution.
Well, no, and as you say, so much good has come out of this, and I think it's not an exaggeration. Look, this led to the 84 LA Olympic marathon for women for the first time in history, and Title IX. And I mean, this had a profound impact on the future of women's sports.
It really did, and of course, it inspired me tremendously. You know, I went from creating a club to writing that proposal to Avon that created that global series of women's races. Eventually, we had 400 races in 27 countries, you know, and then I could use the data and statistics from those races to lobby the IOC. And then the IOC had no choice. They had to vote the distance into the Olympic Games because we had the numbers, the medical evidence, and the performances and the international representation. So,
amazing.
Great things. And one thing I love telling is one race that was really, really tremendously significant is that the Avon series had the culmination every year of this series of races around the world was a world-class marathon. All the races were world-class, and the world-class marathon. And in 80, we had it in London and closed downtown London streets for the first time in history for sports events. And the leader of the Greater London Council said, "Ladies, I have to salute you. We've only closed these roads before for the Queen."
And so how appropriate.
That was monumental. That was monumental because we also had 27 countries, 5 continents, and the IOC had requested 24 countries and 3 continents. So we'd exceeded that. But a little known fact that I bet you don't even know is that that race was a design model for the London Marathon.
Oh, the
because
Brasher
the London
then
yeah
picked that up.
The Brasher Marathon. He didn't want me in London. You know, Brasher wanted me to go take my race someplace
else.
He wanted to be the first, and of Scotland Yard and the London Council needed a smaller race as a design model to see if it would work. Now
Very
they didn't tell me that, but I knew that. And of course, what was fun is that Brasher and I actually became friends eventually too. And of course, the London Marathon is one of the greatest races
Absolutely.
In the world. Absolutely. And I'd been there many times as a journalist, and I'd crossed Westminster Bridge with my team in 1980, but I had never run it. So in 2018,
okay.
which was the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote in the UK, in England, I ran it. And it was sensational. It was just
That's so good. Because you were, if I'm doing the math right, 71 at that point?
Yeah. I was, yeah.
Because not that many people know that, most runners that we all know would tell you very, very quickly what their PR, within the first 5 minutes of any conversation, they'll tell you what their PR was in a marathon. But most people don't know that you won the New York Marathon, and that you run sub 3 hour marathons. You were one of the top 6 marathoners in the world at the time.
Well, the reason I don't brag about the time is because it wasn't the time. I mean, for me, it took so much work to do it. But the reason I am excited about my 2:51 at Boston in 1975 was because if I could do it, anybody could do it. Meaning if you are really willing to work hard, your body is so amazing and so fantastic. If you're willing to dedicate, you know, like I was doing double workouts, 110 miles a week, it took me 8 years and I finally got a 2:51. Now, you have to be pretty dedicated to do that. But I also had a big chip on my shoulder, you know, which was I was proving to Jock Semple's ghost. Well, he was alive
That's
then,
right.
so he was impressed. Jock Semple, after I finished the Boston Marathon, said to the media the next day, he said, 420. Anybody can do 420. I can walk it that fast. I was so humiliated. I said, okay, I'm going to really train hard and see how fast I can go. So I figured if I could do that, how much talent existed among women and that women didn't even know?
Absolutely.
I mean, I was looking at that time, I was looking at women like Greta Weitz, you know, who, you know, was finishing, third or fourth in the Olympic 1500. She had set a world record in the women's 3000, but she considered the marathon kind of a circus event. And it wasn't until she came over, you know, in 1979 with Fred Lebow inviting her to run.
Queen of New York.
She didn't even know the real distance. She didn't take it seriously. And she ran a world record. And once we got the marathon in the Olympic Games, then her focus changed, yeah. You know? Then everybody who, all of that talent switched when they started realizing that they had the ability to go long. It was awesome for that mindset to change. Well, and she was then became a very, very good spokesperson.
Oh, no, she was amazing, yeah, for years.
Yeah.
But what was it in your personal makeup? You were an accidental hero, right? You didn't set out that day to garner press attention. You weren't trying to change the world, but you know, maybe it's some sort of divine or cosmic intervention, because you wound up being a great vehicle for this movement. But what about your makeup made you keep going? I mean, you could have easily gone back to Syracuse and said, I'm done with this running thing, and I didn't prove my point. But what about your upbringing or your personal composition made you run with that, no pun intended?
David, I got to tell you, I mean, we're surrounded by social injustice and everybody has an opportunity to make change. Most people don't. Mm-hmm. And so at the moment I'd made the decision to finish the race, I made the decision, I knew it was going to be the harder choice. I could have stepped off the course, gone home to my mom and said, screw this, you know? But I felt, and here's part of my makeup, I am a very determined person, first of all, but I am overburdened with responsibility. If you want to know the truth, my parents always hammered that into me, that if you do something, you've got to take responsibility for it. And you've got to take responsibility for your own actions and for yourself. And so when you say, was there some kind of divine intervention? It was an amazing collision of circumstances that happened that day. But a lot of us have circumstances in our life and we're not even seeing them. And you say, you know, you make choices all the time. When you have a choice, it's obvious and you walk away from it. I swear, you live with bitterness the rest of your life because you always say, I really should have done something.
Oh, man. And, we all have those regrets lists. There's nothing worse, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I tell you, sometimes it's as simple as telling a little girl or boy, hey, you're great. Go for it. Attaboy. You know, I think you're terrific. You can do anything. Sometimes just a simple thing that makes all the difference.
I love it.
But it was my dad who encouraged me to run when I was 12.
Was he a little bit ahead of his time? Was he a little bit progressive?
He was, but he was also really conservative. I mean, he was a military colonel. Hmm. So he was, you know, kind of, you know, conservative in many ways, but he was a great motivator. Probably one reason why he was successful in the military,
right?
Because of that. When I told him I wanted to be a high school cheerleader, he said, you don't want to do that. Cheerleaders cheer for other people. You want people to cheer for you. And that life is to participate, not spectate. You should go play on the field hockey team in your school. It's something new. I don't know what it is. I know they run. And if you ran a mile a day, you'd be the best player. Just like that. And I said, I can't possibly run a mile. He said, sure you can. I'll show you. You know, he measured off the yard and he said, so many words of wisdom that he doesn't even remember, but it was it's not about going fast. It's just about finishing. Just always finish the job. And I often say that to people, destiny is about finishing the job. You know, destiny was about finishing the Boston Marathon in 1967. Love Everything it. Would have been different if I quit. Everything, you know?
Yeah. Another. I mean, I think that the pendulum would have eventually swung in the right direction, but
it may have taken
another 15, 20 years.
Yeah, or whatever. Yeah. If we followed the natural progression of women's event inclusion in the Olympic Games, right? It would, the women's marathon wouldn't have been included in 2012, earliest.
Yeah, you know? I totally agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've been so generous with your time. We've had a little fun segment with a couple of other guests. We'll hit you really quickly with a couple rapid fire questions, and then we will let you get on with your day in beautiful New Zealand. But so real quick, favorite book of all time.
Favorite book of all time.
Yes. You're not allowed to say one of your own.
I'm not allowed to say one of my own. I do love Marathon Woman. I got it out again last night, and I said, shit, that introduction is terrific.
Good, right? Yeah, yeah.
Middlemarch, George Eliot.
Oh, good. A classic. Favorite movie?
Chariots of Fire.
Oh, good for you.
But my film Marathon Woman is being made into a feature film. So we're hoping that might be the best film.
So what actress should play you in your movie?
Well, I would love it to be Margot Robbie. Absolutely.
I love it. Another smart, gorgeous, talented, athletic woman. Perfect.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. Are you still running in Adidas shoes?
I am still running in Adidas shoes. In fact, I'm now a professional athlete, as I get paid to wear Adidas clothes and be a spokesperson ambassador for them. And it's really cool because I did not become a professional athlete till I was 68 years old. Isn't that great? After all those years, finally, I became a professional athlete. It's a thrill for me.
Morning runner or evening runner?
Definitely evening runner. I need to get over the day rather than start the day.
Same. I wish we were the opposite, but I'm the same. Last question. You have actual examples of this, but you could have done dinner with one famous person, living or dead. Who would it be?
Barack Obama.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
And you have not met him?
Nope, I haven't. I would love to meet him.
Absolutely. No, another transcendent figure. You are so kind to spend time with us. This is great stuff. Your energy level is amazing. And I assume you're still running. Are you healthy?
Oh, yeah. I had a bad Achilles last year out of the blue. And it's because I stopped doing my core work. I ran, but I didn't do my core work. I mean, it gets you. And so I started from scratch again, gained weight, and started, an hour walk a day with 1 minute running and the incredible number of calf raises and heel dips again. And I'm up to now 55 minutes, every other day.
Oh, so, good for you.
So I'm really almost back.
Well, it wouldn't be a running conversation if we didn't complain to each other about injuries. So I'm glad we got that in there, but absolutely. Thank you so much. You're the best.